You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Wednesday the 16th of February 2022, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Well, we've got a bit of a funny article to get into first here, which comes from Britain, from the legal profession. Britain's traditional barrister wigs are culturally insensitive and should be prohibited, a leading black barrister has said. Now, barrister wigs have been around for a long time, and I guess the rest of the world probably look at our courts and they think we probably look a little bit silly with our solicitors and judges and the wigs that they wear, and they quite clearly go back to a couple of hundred years ago. Why should people a couple of hundred years ago been culturally sensitive to cultures from the other side of the world? Is that what he's meaning here? I mean, it does say they are traditional barrister wigs, so they're obviously a tradition. They obviously go back some time. They obviously go back to before the policy of multiculturalism. So, of course, they're going to be different to cultures today. I mean, what is his problem with it? How can he say that they are culturally insensitive? Leslie Thomas, QC, claimed the white Georgian-style wigs look ridiculous on black advocates and are fashioned for Caucasian hair. Well, of course they're fashioned for Caucasian hair. There was nobody but Caucasians living in Britain in the Georgian times. And they look ridiculous on white people, just as ridiculous as they look on black people. I mean, they're just not a fashionable thing that people wear today. They're not culturally sensitive to the culture that we have today, but they're not supposed to be. They are supposed to be a tradition. It came after a black barrister with an afro, a specialist in public and human rights cases, Michael Etienne, was informed that he risked being in contempt of court if he refused to put one on. So his problem here is because he wants to wear an afro. But, I mean, if the uniform says that you need to wear a wig, then you might not be able to wear your hair in an afro style, surely. If you have to wear a helmet, for instance, for your job, then you're not going to be able to wear your hair in an afro style. If you are working amongst machinery and you have long hair, and you're a Caucasian, you are not going to be able to have your hair out and hanging down working amongst machinery. You are going to have to tie it up and probably put it inside a hairnet. Hairnets don't look particularly flattering either. I mean, this is just a part of the normal uniform for the legal profession here that he is complaining about. The junior barrister tweeted, asked the bar counsel what would happen if, as a black barrister with an afro, I declined to wear my wig. The answer included contempt of court, wasted costs, and various potential breaches of code of conduct, unless the insistence was discriminatory. And he added the hashtag hair discrimination to his tweet. So, of course, he's going to claim that he is being discriminated against because the wig looks silly on his head. Well, it looks silly on white people's heads too, doesn't it? But it is just a part of our traditions that we have here in Britain, our quaint traditions. Etienne added, to be clear, I did not ask for dispensation. I asked the Bar Council for an indication of whether I might be at risk of sanction. And yes, of course he is. Anybody that is part of that profession and doesn't wear a wig is going to be at risk of sanction. It's not because he's been picked on because he's black that he might be at risk of sanction. He said the Bar Council doesn't make the rules, but it is supposed to be the representative body, so we might hope it takes proactive steps to address this issue in the interests of its black members. Again, what about in the interests of its white members? White people don't look too good in these wigs either. They just look silly, but that's it. That's part of their profession. I don't know what the reason for it is, but it basically shows us that fashions change over the years. Everybody used to wear wigs at one point. Everybody used to wear top hats. I expect a top hat would probably look silly on his afro as well. So don't wear a top hat, or if you're in a profession where you have to wear a top hat, then he's going to have to find some way of doing it, cutting his hair maybe. A fellow Twitter user said that perhaps Mr. Etienne could tie his hair back, and he replied, "Afro doesn't just tie back. Tie it down maybe, but I object to restraining my hair as a condition of going to work." And there we have it. I mean, how many professions do people have to restrain their hair in order to go about their profession? Quite a few. If you're working in a food factory, for instance, you're going to have to wear a hairnet. If you're working in a hospital, you're going to have to tie your hair back and cover it. If you're working with machinery, you're going to have to do that. If you have to wear a helmet, you're going to have to do that. He thinks he shouldn't have to do that because he's black and he has this black privilege, which means that they don't have to do certain things that white people do, or at least he seems to think that, doesn't he? So we'll have to see what happens here, see whether black people get a special dispensation so that they don't actually have to wear the uniform that everybody else has to wear, even though, of course, race is just a skin colour. So I don't really see how his hair can be any different if race is just a skin colour and no more than that. Funny, isn't it, the way that we're now accused of having racist wigs, basically, in the law profession. Moving on to a more serious subject here to do with illegal immigration into Britain. The Home Office has ordered 29 councils to take into their care migrant children who arrive to the UK without parents or guardians, adding to the 177 who are already mandated to do so. It comes after a voluntary scheme to house the unaccompanied youngsters, including those making the perilous channel crossing to England's southern coast, had to be made compulsory last year when too few local authorities opted in. So at least there are some local authorities that are standing up for their own people here and are saying, well, we would rather not actually take these people in from another country. We do have our own people that we need to take care of, and we don't really have room for that, let alone room for people from the other side of the world. And then you've also got the issue that these so-called migrant children, apparently 80% of the ones that come into Britain and claim to be under the age of 18 actually aren't under the age of 18. And you wonder what is happening to the ones that are not being put into these care homes. Are they being put with foster families? Do we have foster families with 20, 22-year-old males there that are pretending to be 13 or 14 years old? Because we certainly don't have enough room for them in all the care homes. When the scheme was voluntary, this resulted in significant pressure on the few which did opt in, Home Office said, as Home Secretary Priti Patel insisted councils across the country needed to play their part. The more than two dozen newly selected councils have not been named, but they include 12 who said they were already caring for high numbers of migrant children, and 17 who applied to be exempt from the scheme. Pressure on children's services and the current child populations were among the criteria used to select the 29 councils, and I guess that was also among the criteria for saying, well, we don't think that we're actually able to do this in this part of the country. Any local authority caring for a child transferred through the mandatory scheme receives a funding contribution of £143 per child per night, according to the Home Office, after an extra £20 million of additional funding was made available to further support local authorities last year. So this is costing us huge amounts of money. It comes after last year saw a record 28,395 migrants reach the UK, with numbers feared to increase yet again in 2022 following the chaotic fall of Afghanistan to the Taliban. Now, what are we doing with these unaccompanied migrants? Why are they coming to Britain? Well, one of the reasons is because they claim that they already have family here. So that's why they're coming over here, and some of them will get put with the family that they claim to actually be with when they're here. Others come here and they claim that they've lost their family and they don't have a family, and they just thought that Britain was so welcoming and so kind that they would travel across 10 or 11 different countries to get here because they knew that we would look after them. And of course, once they get taken in, once we say, well, they're an unaccompanied migrant and we put them in a care home, then they can apply for citizenship status. And as soon as they've done that, then they can call for the rest of their family to come and live here. They say that they have a right to a family. The Human Rights Act says that people have a right to a family life. So they can then apply to have all their cousins and uncles and aunts and all the rest of them to come to Britain. So they know that once one of their children has actually made it into the country, then the rest of them can follow. It's similar to the anchor baby phenomenon that you used to get in America, where immigrants would, or illegal immigrants would, get pregnant and then have a child. And once they had the child, they were allowed to stay in the country. And it's the same here. Once an unaccompanied migrant manages to make it into the country, then they can call for the rest of their family to come. And really, we should be looking at this and saying, well, hang on a minute, this child is unaccompanied. Should we not be reporting that to the authorities in the country that they claim to have come from, so that the parents can be arrested for letting their child do something as dangerous as this? And should we not then be sending the child back over there to be looked after by the care system over there? Or are they going to say that these children are somehow in danger of being attacked by the regime in the country that they're from? Surely not. If they're claiming to be under the age of 16, how can they be held responsible for anything? And how can they have a fear that they're going to be attacked by the regime in their own country when they're children? Are they fearful of their own people attacking them when they're a child? I mean, just look at the way that we look after children here in Britain, and we're so generous. What we're effectively doing here is looking after the children from another family instead of from our own family. And I dare say the Afghans are also just as kindly and protective over their own children as we are here. If we were to be sending these children back to the Taliban to look after, to the Afghan authorities to look after, why would they have any fear of being attacked by the authorities? And if you really want to think carefully about it, they were probably in far more danger under the American occupation, when the abuse of children was turned a blind eye to. In November, Kevin Foster, one of the government's immigration ministers, wrote to all 217 councils with children's services across the country, informing them of plans to temporarily mandate the national transfer scheme and giving them 2 weeks to present reasons why they should not accept them. So the councils are all going to be forced to accept these so-called unaccompanied minors. And we know that from the studies that have been done across Europe, from dental records that have been taken from them, it is on average about 80% of them that are actually over the age of 18 and that are just pretending to be minors. And they're going to be put in these children's homes. They're going to be put in with foster families. And the councils that tried to say, well, no, we don't want to do this, they're all going to be forced to go along with it. The Home Office refused to disclose the names of which councils it has now contacted. Mr. Foster said, I am grateful for the continued support of local authorities who have already stepped up to help more unaccompanied asylum-seeking children. I mean, it's really neglect of a child to let your child make his way across the continent to get into Britain. You just know that the rest of the family are waiting there in France for the child to get through so that they can then ask to come through themselves. Mandating the scheme has already led to additional placements, but we know there is more work to be done, he said. Factors including the existing child population, pressures on children's services, and the number of asylum seekers being supported in the area will all be considered, as well as the best interests of the child. The Home Office previously said surely the best interests of the child would be to be with their own people, with their own family, in their own country, not over the other side of the world. I mean, you really would have thought that would always be in the best interests of the child, to be amongst their own people. I mean, that is just a basic instinct of a child, to want to be among their own people. Councils will not have to accept more unaccompanied child migrants if they already make up 0.07% or more of its general population. So that's good, at least. They're not saying you have to take 25% child migrants or anything like that. It is under 1%. The plans will be kept under review, and how long it remains mandatory will depend on factors including intake levels and how long it takes to end the use of hotels. So up until now, they're all being put up in 3- and 4-star hotels. I mean, what sort of a magnet do they think this is to illegal immigrants, to know that if they can make it to Britain, they will be put up in a hotel as if they have just gone away on holiday? You know, I wonder if some of these people do just do that. Like we used to go on a tour of Europe, take a year out and go on a tour of Europe if you were a student at university. And now if you're a well-off Afghan or a well-off Syrian, you can go on a tour of Europe, and you can get it all paid for by the Europeans, and just claim that you're here claiming asylum, and you'll get put up in a hotel. And when you've had enough of it, you can go back, or you can stay here. And if you really like it, you can call for the rest of your family to come as well. I mean, we are really being taken advantage of here with our lax immigration policy and the asylum policy and the asylum treaties, which are really being abused. I mean, those asylum treaties were meant for European countries if they were at war, and Europeans needed to claim asylum in the country that was next door to them. It was never intended to provide a route for economic migrants, which is what the majority of these are. They're looking for a better life in Britain. They're not really looking for just somewhere to get away from war. It comes after it was revealed at the weekend that ministers have been warned by intelligence experts that more than 500,000 Afghan migrants have crossed the border since the fall of Kabul last year and are heading for Europe and the Channel Coast. Why are they heading for Europe? Why are they not going into Kyrgyzstan, Pakistan, Kazakhstan, all the countries that surround Afghanistan that have similar cultures, a similar ethnicity, and are likely to help them out? The reason is because they think, well, we might as well head to Europe and become an economic migrant. That's the reason. They're heading for Europe because it has a better economy, and they think they have a better chance of doing better for themselves. I mean, really, Afghanistan needs them to stay in Afghanistan and help build the country up. That's what the government over there has said. They want the Afghans to stay there. They want them to know that they're going to do their very best for them. And you have to take them on their word at that. They do show a lot of ethnic loyalty, and they particularly want the bright ones to stay there and help them to rebuild the country. Far better than accepting all of these people that want to leave there into Britain. It would be far better if we just helped Afghanistan out. Help them out rebuilding the country. So much money was being sent to Afghanistan when it was under occupation, and all of that money's now been stopped, and all the bank accounts have been frozen, and we appear to be doing our best to try and make it as difficult as possible for the Afghans to raise their standard of living. And at the same time, we're saying, come over here to Britain and we'll look after you. It really doesn't make a lot of sense, our foreign policy. The Home Secretary is seeking to toughen the UK's response to migrants who cross the Channel, with Border Force teams moving between hotels in Britain to round up migrants and move them to holding centres on military bases. But there hasn't been that many that have been put on military bases. There were some that were put on military bases just before Christmas, and they tried to burn the place down, and they ended up getting moved into a hotel. And even the ones in hotels complain about the food. There was one that went crazy with a knife stabbing people up in Glasgow because he didn't like the food and the internet speed in the hotel wasn't fast enough for him. And these are not people that are just desperate to get away from a war-torn situation. They've been told that they will have a much better life here, the economy's much better, and they've been told that we are desperate to have them over here. This is the thing. I mean, this became clear to me when I saw interviews with some of them that were on the Belarus border. But somebody has been telling them that we are desperate to have them in our countries, and we really love them, and we really love Islam, and we really want them to come over here. And if they come over here, we will give them a free house, we will give them a free car, all this sort of stuff. And then they get here, and they realize they don't get that. And even though they're put up in a hotel, it's not the sort of food they like, and then they get angry. And the people that are telling them these things, I think it's these NGOs. It's got to be these NGOs that go out there and give them all the information on how to break into Europe. And they say to them, well, you'll be much better off in Europe. You'll be able to earn money. You'll be able to get benefits. And then they get here and they realize it's not quite so good. It's these NGOs that are doing this. And the government talks about the human traffickers and how we must go after them. There would be no cargo for the human traffickers if it wasn't for the NGOs encouraging the people to become cargo for them. Around 12,000 Afghan refugees are currently living in UK hotels, with permanent homes so far found for more than 4,000. So a third of the Afghans that have managed to make their way over here have all been given homes already. They've all been given their own homes after being in the country for what, 3-4 months? How many years do we have Indigenous Britons waiting on the list to be given a council house? And yet a third of the Afghan refugees have all been given permanent homes. And of course, I do have to remind people to please don't resent the Afghans for that. It is our government that is at fault for giving them these homes. You cannot blame these people for coming here at all, because they've been told they're going to have a much better life over here if they come over here. It is our government's fault for the way that they deal with it, not the Afghans' fault that they're being given these homes. And really, I mean, the government appear to be trying to stoke up division between us by doing this sort of thing and by not standing up for the Indigenous Britons. The government has faced acute embarrassment over its failure to stem illegal migration on small boats across the channel. More than 28,000 migrants used the route last year, triple the number recorded in 2020. So we could very well have 100,000 turn up this year. A further 1,341 successfully made the journey last month, and it was recently reported that the army is beginning to build camps on the Ministry of Defence land to house up to 30,000 of these channel migrants. Why are they building these camps in Britain? Why are they not building these camps in another third country? I mean, that would dissuade them from coming here. Now, for years now, I've been pointing out that the solution to this problem is the same solution that they had in Australia. And what they did in Australia is they spoke to Papua New Guinea, which is a nearby country, and they leased some land from Papua New Guinea and they built camps there. And they said, anybody that tries to break into Australia, you will not be given citizenship. You will not be allowed into the country. We will look after you, though, and we will put you somewhere safe, and we will feed you and clothe you and look after you. But it will not be in Australia. It will be in Papua New Guinea, which is a nice tropical temperature, and it has nice sandy beaches, but it's a developing country. It's not up to the same standards that Australia is. So, of course, it doesn't have the big pull factor that Australia does, and all the illegal immigrants stopped coming into Australia on boats because Australia did this. That's all Britain needs to do, and Australia did this years ago, probably about 10 years ago they did this, and they didn't get into any trouble, they didn't break any UN treaties by doing that. So why doesn't Britain do it? And I've been pointing this out for ages. And finally, now, it looks like that may happen, or at least some people are suggesting that it should happen. Channel migrants should be deported to offshore processing centres within 48 hours of arrival, a new report says today. the think tank Policy Exchange, suggested processing centres should be set up on the British overseas territory of St Helena, Ascension and Tristan da Cunha if the French government fails to take back migrants. And they're all in the South Atlantic. So again, it's quite temperate there. It's not a bad temperature. It's not like putting them up there in the Outer Hebrides or something. It's a nice temperature. And these migrants would not be a threat of war or anything like that, but they would not be in Britain, basically. So this would prevent them from wanting to use this route to try to get into Britain. Alternative locations could include the Channel Islands or a 98 square mile area of Cyprus known as the Sovereign Base Areas, which has been maintained under treaty by the UK since 1960, it added. And I don't think either of those is a good solution because they're still a part of Britain, aren't they? The Channel Islands is part of Britain. If they're there, the likelihood is they'll be able to escape or whatever. And then they will be in Britain. If they're Cyprus and they manage to get out, then they're already in Europe once again. They need to be out of Europe. I mean, they're saying here, well, use the British overseas territory and the South Atlantic, but how about just purchase some territory in Africa, in North Africa, and put them there? I mean, you might even end up with asylum seekers just going directly to that part of North Africa and instead of trying to make their way across Europe. The genuine ones, that is, that were fleeing war, you wouldn't get the economic migrants doing that. Since the aim of the policy would be to discourage attempts to cross the Channel in small boats without leave to enter the UK, immediate return to France is the best policy if available, the report said. I don't think that is the best policy because that just dumps the problem on France's doorstep, doesn't it? And that they're still within Europe, they're still economic migrants, it just then becomes a problem for France to deal with. But if an agreement with France proves impossible, the UK government should introduce what Policy Exchange described as Plan B, it went on. This would see all migrants removed to a British territory overseas after a 48-hour screening period. Claims would then be processed by British officials at specially built centres. And anyone ascertained to be a genuine refugee will be taken from there as the final stage of their deportation to a third state, which has agreed with the UK to accept refugees deported from UK waters or the UK, it went on. And that's a great idea, that is, because there are lots of countries that are not at war, countries in Africa, what have you. And if these alleged refugees are what we're told they are, highly qualified doctors and what have you that are fleeing from oppression in their own countries, then they would be of a lot of use to a developing country in Africa, wouldn't they? Doctors and lawyers and scientists and all these brainy types that we're told actually make up the majority of these refugees that are coming here. So if they were then deported to a third country, it would benefit the third country. And it was also deter them from doing this if they thought that they were not going to get to Britain at all. Thereafter, save in the most exceptional cases, refugees thus resettled will be automatically refused leave to enter the UK for any purpose. So this is a great idea. Will the government follow it, though? This is the Policy Exchange that are suggesting this, and I don't know how well they are listened to. Ascension Island in the South Atlantic was the most obviously suitable location for an offshore processing centre because it has a runway capable of handling large aircraft and also enjoys a mild, stable climate, the report went on. Among the Channel Islands, it proposed Alderney would be the most suitable. Director of Policy Exchange Dean Godson said, "It is absolutely clear that we must do something about the ongoing small boats crisis. We have people being exploited by ruthless smugglers and traffickers, put in extreme danger, and tragically, in some cases, losing their lives, and we cannot allow this to continue. At the moment, we have thousands of people placing themselves in jeopardy, even though they are already in a safe country, trying to cross the channel. It is vital we now end the incentive to do so." And basically what he's saying there is, this is good for these people themselves that we are suggesting this. And of course, when we here at Radio Albion talk about these things, we point out that it's also going to be good for the indigenous Britons for this to happen. And at the same time, it's also going to be good for the migrants for this to happen, because they're not then going to drown at sea. And we have had quite a few of them drown at sea. So let's finish up with what the government has to say about this. They say, for over two decades, the public have been crying out for the broken asylum system to be reformed. So why haven't they fixed it? I mean, it's really not that difficult to do. Australia did it 10 years ago. What has stopped Britain from doing it? The government spokesman continued, that's what this government is delivering through our new plan for immigration. The government's Nationality and Borders Bill will make it a criminal offence to knowingly arrive in the UK illegally and introduce life sentences for those who facilitate illegal entry into the country. Well, that's not going to stop them coming either, is it? If they just end up getting put in prison for a while, they're probably better off in a British prison than they are in some of these countries that they've come from, some of these very poor countries that they've come from. I already thought it was a criminal offence to break into the country. I mean, it certainly should be a criminal offence. And they say they're going to introduce life sentences for those facilitating this illegal entry. Are they going to do that for the NGOs? Of course not. They give money to these NGOs and these charities that encourage this. Or at least we were giving money to these NGOs when we were part of the EU, and the EU donates this money, and the National Lottery gives these groups this money, and then they encourage people to break into our country. It will also strengthen the powers of Border Force to stop and redirect vessels, while introducing new powers to remove asylum seekers to have their claims processed outside the UK. So the first part of that it's going to strengthen Border Force to stop and redirect vessels, well, that's absolutely impossible, isn't it? If they try to turn a vessel around, the migrants will just stab the inflatable dinghy, they'll fall into the sea, and Border Force will have to rescue them. And once they're on the Border Force boat, they will have to take them into Britain, and they won't have arrived illegally because they will be on the Border Force boat. But the second part of this, introducing new powers to remove asylum seekers to have their claims processed outside the UK, that is absolutely fantastic if they do actually do this. We will have to wait and see, and I do think the South Atlantic is a good choice of place to put them. Well, thank you very much for listening. I'll be back tomorrow with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson. God bless, and hail victory.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.